From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Neil Young once sang that rock and roll can never die. But what if there's nowhere to buy guitars? Then the Prince Archive has untold amounts of unreleased music. Susan Rogers, one of his recording engineers, recounts how her dream job with Prince came with a steep price.
24 hours was normal, 48 hours was not uncommon, and the longest one I ever did was 96 hours with no sleep. That's how we worked.
And we take a road trip with Dana Gioia, California's poet laureate. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Ever since 1985, Guitar Center on Sunset Boulevard has been the go-to shop for big stars and countless wannabes. The store even has its own Walk of Fame. But earlier this year, there were reports that Guitar Center was going bankrupt. Now that tune might be changing. The music store last week unveiled its newly refurbished Hollywood flagship location, with plans to open several more new stores by the end of the year. For more on how Guitar Center has managed to stay afloat when other big box retailers like Toys R Us have been biting the dust, we turn to Billboard contributor Andy Herman. When we connected via Skype, I started our conversation by asking Herman how Guitar Center has seemingly come back for an encore.
Because GCI is a privately held company, some of the maneuvering is still shrouded in secrecy. However, what we do know is that they announced a refinancing earlier this year in which they were able to stall any payments on their debt until 2021. They still carry a debt load of around $1.3 billion, but apparently their strategy is to essentially spend their way out of that debt by continuing to expand the chain and renovate and refurbish some of their flagship stores, including the one in Hollywood.
It seems like it's been very hard for a lot of brick and mortar or big box retail businesses like Toys R Us, because you can get those things on websites like Amazon. Guitar Center seems to be a little bit different, and it's a little bit, I guess, like buying a car. You want to drive it first. Is that important to their success, that people want to come in and actually play the guitars, and has the chain recognized that and embraced it?
The answer to the first part of that question is yes, absolutely. I know that, you know, myself as an amateur musician, I always want to actually hold the instrument in my hands before I buy it. And the second part of that question is yes, I do think Guitar Center has sort of woken up to the fact that they need to make their stores more interactive to compete with online sellers. And at the Hollywood store, you could see where they're attempting to do that. They have sort of strategically placed red signs all throughout the store that say "Play Me" on everything from guitars to hand drums to keyboards. And when I interviewed some of the executive staff at Guitar Center and got a tour of the place, they emphasized to me over and over again that one of the things that they were trying to do is kind of make the retail experience there more interactive.
One of the things that Guitar Center has been criticized for in the past is not being very customer friendly and really not catering to women. And I've seen a number that I think women now make up for as much as half of all guitar buyers. Are they also trying to change their customer service dynamic and actually be more welcoming to all kinds of musicians?
Yes, we did talk about that as well. And they did mention the numbers that you cite, which were actually from a study that Fender Guitars did, where they found out that half of their customer base is now female. So, I think Guitar Center is aware that the demographics of their customer base is changing and that they have to contend with a perception that the sort of average guitar showroom clerk, you know, maybe a dude who has the tendency to perhaps mansplain his inventory to female customers. You know, whether they can course correct for that kind of thing or not, I think remains to be seen. When I was in the store on Saturday, you know, I definitely saw a lot of women in the store. I didn't necessarily see a preponderance of women in the guitar showroom. It's still mostly guys around testing out the models, but I'm sure the Guitar Center wants to change that.
I want to ask about a parallel retail experience. Obviously, we live in a streaming era. We can listen to music on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music, YouTube. And yet, if you go to a store like Amoeba, it's filled with people kind of leafing through or thumbing through vinyl records. Is part of this, too, a flashback experience that even though we're surrounded by electronic means to create music, there is a new appeal in picking up an acoustic guitar and actually strumming it?
I think there may be something to that. And in fact, it's interesting, contrary to there's a perception that the guitar is sort of this dying, unfashionable instrument, right? But since 2008, guitar sales are actually up 28%. But most of those gains in sales are actually through acoustic fretted instruments. So yeah, I do think there is a trend towards people wanting to kind of return to this more tactile experience. There's probably an analogy to be made in the resurgence of vinyl sales. I think it's probably a similar urge that consumers feel towards something that feels a little more handheld and wooden and for lack of a better term, and you know, handcrafted.
And yet it has been difficult for manufacturers. Gibson Guitar filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. So why are its fortunes not as closely aligned with Guitar Center right now?
Well, it's interesting about Gibson. They actually revealed in their bankruptcy filing that their sale of electric guitars was actually up by 10% the year before they filed for bankruptcy. So Gibson's bankruptcy had more to do with their attempt to expand into consumer electronics, by which they mean things like keyboards and synthesizers and outboard gear for electronic musicians. Gibson basically admitted that they just went about it in a not very effective way and overspent and overextended the company. And that was actually what led to the bankruptcy.
If you go into some kitchen stores like Williams-Sonoma or Sur La Table, you might see somebody doing a demonstration of cooking that's going to inspire you to actually buy some new pots and pans. Is Guitar Center trying to do the same with live performance, that they're going to bring in people who are not only going to perform, but maybe talk about music making in hopes that that sparks consumer interest in making a purchase?
They had sort of a week of events leading up to the sort of grand reopening of the Hollywood store. It seems like part of their plan is to continue to live events and product demonstrations.
Andy Herman is a contributor to Billboard. He's the author of the article, Guitar Center Unveils Remodeled Hollywood Store and How It Plans to Come Back from the Brink. Andy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks again.
Coming up, tales from inside the studio with Prince from one of his former engineers.
You get a fast car. KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, Justin Sayer, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Back in September, the Prince Estate released a collection of demo tapes from his archival recordings called Piano and a Microphone, 1983. The recordings are rough sketches of songs, some of which would go on to be huge hits. They're also a look into the creative process of the musical genius who died more than 2 years ago. The Prince Estate is sitting on a huge amount of unheard material, some of which may be released in the future, and the people responsible for keeping the tape rolling throughout those nonstop rehearsals and recording sessions were his engineers. Susan Rogers is a studio engineer and professor at Berklee College of Music. She worked with Prince between 1983 and 1987, a prolific period that produced Purple Rain, Kiss, Raspberry Beret, and other iconic hits. When I spoke with her via Skype, we started in 1983 when she was an aspiring engineer in a male-dominated industry.
I was living and working in Hollywood. I worked for a studio called Rudy Records, right in Crossroads of the World on Sunset Boulevard, right in Hollywood. The studio was owned by Graham Nash of Crosby, Stills & Nash. I was their studio maintenance technician. So I had had 5 years of training as an audio tech. I was a big Prince fan. And in my dreams, in my fantasies, I would have had, my dream would have come true, and I would have gotten the call, Prince is looking for a technician. And that's exactly what happened.
When you first heard Prince's music, even before you started working with him, what excited you about it? What were you reacting to as a listener before you were working as a colleague?
He represented a couple of things that I loved most about music. I loved art music and folks who were trying to push the boundaries of the status quo, and that included punk and disco. Just any new trend I would be interested in. But I have always lived on the street of R&B and soul music. So this was a soul music artist who had an art music sensibility. So he was the perfect artist for me.
I'm sure there are very few typical days when you're working with Prince. I know there are a lot of very long days, but how would you describe your relationship with him? Would it often be the two of you in studio? Would it be a lot of other engineers around? What did it actually look like?
For the most part, during the time I was with him, I was his full-time engineer. I'm only human, unlike Prince, who seemed to be kind of superhuman. If I would conk out after 24 hours and need to sleep for a few hours, then our technician, the great Sal Greco, could help out for a few hours. 24 hours was normal. 48 hours was not uncommon. And the longest one I ever did was 96 hours with no sleep. That's how we worked. But for the most part, during the time when I was with him, there was a lot of time that he and I spent alone recording at his home studio.
The latest release from the Prince Estate, Piano and a Microphone, was recorded in 1983, which was the same year that you started working with him. And I'm curious what kinds of memories those recordings spark in your own mind.
His day-to-day work life. We would be recording at his home studio. I worked for him before Paisley Park Studios was built. So we would work at his bedroom studio at home. We would also record at rehearsal. So while I'd be setting up, or any engineer for him would be setting up, Prince would sit at the piano. And if the piano was mic'd, he might sometimes ask you to go ahead and throw a cassette or a tape into record so he could get his ideas down. But nearly every day I heard him on piano or guitar just messing about. Just working things out. This album that's out right now is a special case. He deliberately recorded that, but I would not venture to say that he deliberately recorded it for an audience or for his band or for any reason other than to just capture himself as he's ideating.
Well, it is kind of impossible to know exactly what he wanted. And even if Prince didn't want this new record released in his lifetime, in your opinion, does it provide us with something valuable in understanding his legacy as a musician?
Yes, I think all of it supplies something valuable, but valuable to different people in different ways and in a different hierarchy. I don't think it's right to ask ourselves the question, what would Prince want? I don't think that's right because I don't think it can be answered. I think the question that is more interesting and imperative is, what does Prince's legacy deserve? How should we better understand this American, this musician, this person who was part of one of America's greatest cultural exports, which is our music, and in particular, music made by Black Americans. That's been a strong cultural export for us for generations.
I want to play a demo from Piano and a Microphone. It's called Strange Relationship. And then we're going to hear the final version that you recorded with him on the 1987 album Sign of the Times.
Guess you know well, I don't like winter. Shame and getting kicked out of doing you cold. Oh, what the hell, you all surrender.
What's this strange relationship that we hold on to? Baby, I just can't stand to see you happy. More than that, I hate to see you sad.
So what happens between those two versions? Because clearly there's a lot of change between A and B.
Oh, so great to listen to. The great thing about a piano and a microphone is that, as I said before, we get to hear him think. Strange Relationship was one of those songs that he tried out in a lot of different versions. All songs didn't go that way. Quite a lot of things came right from his head straight onto tape, and that became the canonical version. But Strange Relationship was one of those that he played with in different settings. So he played it with the band live. He tried it in different tempos, and he gave it different feels. He was working on that one for years. I always loved it, and I was surprised it took so long to be fully expressed on Sign of the Times. It was something that, for reasons probably known only to himself, he wasn't entirely satisfied with it initially. He wasn't sure that he had found the best way of expressing this sentiment.
Susan Rogers is a professor of music production and engineering at the Berklee College of Music. She's been talking with us about working with Prince. Was it important to him that he worked with women? Because not only did he work closely with you, he worked with Sheila E., Wendy Melvoin, Lisa Coleman. Was that accidental or intentional?
Sure, it was intentional, but I wouldn't say it was deliberate. Deliberate says, I will not work with a man. I'm going to keep searching until I find a woman. It wasn't like that. Prince liked having good people around him. He didn't make those distinctions. But it was intentional in the sense that I think he especially had a soft spot in his heart for outsiders. So he gave a chance to an 18-year-old Wendy Melvoin on guitar, and he gave a chance to me. He made me his engineer when I joined him as a technician, and I was a pretty rare bird back in those days. He was only too happy to work with the rare birds. He also, I will say this, and I'm pretty confident about it, it was necessary for Prince to be the alpha male in his working environment.
I think it's fair to say, and I suspect you'll agree, the Prince estate is very secretive about what's in the archives and restrictive about what people like you can talk about. Do you sometimes feel like having worked with Prince is kind of like having worked for a secret branch of the government, that they're just things you can't talk about?
I don't understand it. Secrecy in general. I'm a scientist. I have a PhD, and we worship the truth, and our mandate is to go find it and then expose it. And that kind of mind, which is similar to an engineering mind, is the mind that is extremely naive about things like marketing concerns and social relationships and stuff that thinkers like me don't have a clue about. So I don't understand the secrecy, but I'm smart enough to know that just because I don't understand it doesn't mean it isn't valid.
It's fair to say, and I know you would agree, that the music engineering field has a terrible percentage of women working in it. Why is that the case, and how do you think it can be changed?
Oh, this is a great question, and I've been pondering it for 40 years. There are social reasons and biological reasons why there are fewer women engineers. The social reasons have to do with the fact that we rarely see depictions in movies and television of women who are rewarded for a myopic, single-minded devotion to their careers. In contrast, traditionally, we don't punish men for having that myopic focus on their careers. In fact, most of our depictions in popular culture seem to regard them as being a pretty good catch. Look at him. He's out there. Look at Dad. He's working another late night. Say a little prayer for your father, children. Isn't he great? We don't think that so much about mom. It's like, oh, it's kind of sad. She's a great woman and she looks great. Look at her in those high heels. But it's too bad that she can't be there for her husband and her kids. So there are these societal reasons that need to be, and probably will be, eventually changed. But the biological reason won't be changed. But we can change the societal perspective and make it a little bit easier and more welcoming for women to become recording engineers or record producers.
Susan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Coming up, we go along on a road trip with California's poet laureate, Dana Gioia.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind, the story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, now streaming only on Netflix.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Dana Gioia is California born and raised, a Hawthorne boy who went on to chair the National Endowment for the Arts for 6 years, and now he's wrapping up his term as California's Poet Laureate. During his 2-year stint, his goal was to visit all 58 counties in the state, and much of that travel has been done via road trip. KPCC's arts education reporter, Carla Javier, tagged along for one of the last legs of that journey.
When I asked Dana Gioia if I could hitch a ride with him, I didn't actually think he'd say yes. But on a Thursday afternoon, he pulled into the KPCC parking lot.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
It'll be more fun to drop up with someone.
And off we went, me and the California Poet Laureate, on a road trip.
This afternoon, we're driving from Pasadena to Santa Barbara, California. We're doing it in my, 10-year-old car.
Poets Laureate are supposed to make poetry more accessible to everyday Californians. Over the years, past honorees have created a poetry handbook for kids and a unity poem using submissions of lines and phrases from folks around the state. Gioia was appointed by Governor Jerry Brown at the end of 2015, and road trips like this one are part of his project, bringing poetry to audiences in every one of the state's 58 counties. At this point, he doesn't need maps.
We're relying on my very unreliable memory. I figure if I can't find Santa Barbara, I have no right to be the California Poet Laureate.
And at his appearances, he doesn't read alone.
I always insist we get local people to appear with me.
Gioia served as the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts in D.C. for 6 years. While there, he helped launch the Poetry Out Loud program. It's a competition for high school students. So a lot of the time, he won't just invite anyone to read with him. He'll invite youth, like in October in Tujunga, where he had Ventura County's first youth poet laureate, Yannick Sheehy, read.
Super skinny runway models tell me I am nothing more than the size of my jeans. As a little black girl, I dreamed in blonde.
And I end every session with a conversation with the audience.
Like at one of his favorite visits to the city of Madera in the Central Valley.
I think I've had the best question, in the whole tour asked by a farmer. He said, I've never been to a poetry reading before, and I didn't think I'd like it, but I really like it.
And then the farmer asked, can someone without much education write poetry?
Well, first of all, that's such a brilliant and important question, and I would never get asked that question at Berkeley or Stanford or Cornell.
When Gioia says he wouldn't get a question like that at Stanford, I know he means it because he attended Stanford. He has a bachelor's and an MBA from there. He also has a master's in comparative literature from Harvard, and even now he teaches at USC. So he's got some pretty prestigious credentials, but this question of who can write poetry still really resonates with him. I want to understand why. But first, we have to get past the sound bites.
Being Poet Laureate of California is the greatest honor I've had in my life. And the reason is that poetry is my art and California is my home.
Then it all starts to make sense. Gioia wasn't always a prestigious poet, at least not one for a living. For a time, he was a business executive. Rumor has it he played some role in the creation of the Jell-O Jiggler. But when he takes me on the winding road that led him to be California's chief poet, it leads back to his mother.
Who was a working-class Mexican woman, not a lot of education, but who loved poetry.
She'd share her favorites with him. He's 67 now, but he still remembers them.
Touched by sadness, by loss, by death, by what might have been. And so one of her favorites was Annabel Lee by Edgar Allan Poe. It was many and many a year ago, in a kingdom by the sea, that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee.
We spend a lot of our time together like this, with Gioia sharing a relevant stanza from one of the hundreds of poems he's committed to memory, or a relevant memory from one of the hundreds of road trips he's taken across the state.
I bet if we could stop here, we would actually see dolphins breaking the waves. I've done that a couple of times in the past.
At some point, I began to wonder, how does he normally pass the time? Am I cutting into his planning?
Well, I hate to say this on the radio, but I almost never plan what I'm going to read until I see the audience.
Because each time he wants to recite poetry that's relevant to them, whether it's a ballad about his dark family history or some humor.
Okay, we're getting close now. Let's make sure we don't miss our exit.
I try to turn on my GPS
turn
to facilitate
right onto
things.
West Ortega Street, then turn right onto Chapala Street.
I like to do things without Surrey.
All right. She's gone.
As we get closer to Santa Barbara, Joya gets closer to finishing his project and his time as laureate. I ask how he thinks he did.
You mostly fail. You speak to 100 high school kids. 90 of them, you know, may not care. And that's okay. That's okay. If you can reach one or two kids, that is a huge victory.
We get to our destination and park the car.
This place right here, I think.
And at this point, I have to admit something.
I don't know much about poetry, to be honest.
But like many in his audiences, the farmer, like Dana's mom, like Dana himself, I do have this poem that meant a lot to me when I was growing up. Maybe he's heard of it.
It was something about, like, you shall love your neighbor with your crooked heart or something?
Thou shalt love thy crooked neighbor with your crooked heart. It's a line from one of my favorite poems, As I Walked Out One Evening. And I think for America right now, that's something essential for us to remember, that we must love one another. That, you know, if we don't approach the other with a gesture of equality and love and respect, we'll, you know, create a kind of fatal culture.
I thank him for that reminder.
And thank you so much for the ride up to Santa Barbara.
It's been fun. Now let's go out and see what there is to see.
Yeah, let's go.
For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
And that is our show for today. If you're a subscriber to The Frame's weekly newsletter, you'll be hearing from us today. If not, you're missing out. So sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.